This is Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Senior Editor at Yes Media. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Today, we're going to do something different. As you know, I'm Senior Editor at Yes Magazine, and my colleague, Brianna Draxler, also Senior Editor, specializes in environmental justice. She spoke with the co-authors of a new book about family planning in an era of climate change and sits in for me as guest host for this story.
Hello, I'm Brianna Draxler, Senior Editor at Yes Magazine, covering climate, environmental justice, and native rights. And today I'm guest hosting on Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali. I'm here today with Josephine Ferrarelli, a writer, illustrator, and yoga instructor who lives in Chicago, Illinois, and Megan Elizabeth Kallman, a professor, organizer, and state senator representing Rhode Island District 15. Together, they run Conceivable Future, an organization they founded together in 2014, as well as the name of their new book. They host conversations around the country to make space for people to talk about family planning and climate change without judgment. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for having us.
I want to start with the framework that you provide about how people normally see these two issues as connected. And they ask themselves the questions, one, what harm will the world do to a baby that I bring into the world? And two, what harm will my baby do to the world? But you argue that this individualist tale of corrective choices, so-called choices, follows the same dead-end logic that drives climate change in the first place. Can you talk a little bit about how that's the case?
Absolutely. You know, in order to do this appropriately, I've got to give us a little bit of backstory, which is that when Josephine and I were both 30, we met by chance at a social connection. And at that age, at that time, this question of what it would look like to parent during climate breakdown was starting to become more alarmingly relevant for us personally, and also things that, you know, we were seeing. This is obviously alarmingly relevant to lots of people. A recent Business Insider study found that 39% of Americans of childbearing age are, consider climate change as they consider the future of their families. There's a sociologist named Jade Sasser whose work looks at this as well. She has found that these concerns cut across demographics, racial demographics, and socioeconomic demographics. So this was a thing 10 years ago. We met and we had this kind of instant like intellectual and sort of organizing chemistry. We became very close friends very, very quickly, started an organization together in large part because nobody was having these conversations about what climate change meant to us as people. And at the time, the mainstream environmental movement, and I'm being clear to distinguish mainstream from different justice-based portions of the movement, but was very much stuck in like pictures of starving polar bears and calving icebergs and things that were and remain extremely profound and important, and also things that were very hard to connect to when you were, for instance, a 30-year-old living in a city just like trying to do your life. Historically, social movements gather steam when people are able to make a connection between what the threat is to themselves, their communities, their loved ones. Like, that is usually the impetus for action. And the climate movement just wasn't there. That said, we quite quickly learned that, this is an on-ramp for a conversation. This isn't the end of it. We want a world that is safe for everybody's children, not just mine or yours, whether I have six or none or Josephine has two or 12. It's not really the question, right? The question is, how do we create a world that is safe for parents-to-be, people who are aging, the elderly, the very young, the very old, the vulnerable? How can we make a world that is safer for everyone's children? And I will say, though, that over the years, we have had a lot of interest from media, and there has been this kind of nearly obsessive fixation on whether or not there's like a right question. And in the book, a right answer to the question. And in the book and for ourselves, we say there's no right answer to an impossible question, right? The only right answer is to make the world as safe as we can for everyone's children. I'm not in the business of telling anyone what they should or shouldn't do with their bodies. And I certainly don't want anyone to be in the business of telling me what I should do with mine. But what we can all do is work to do the most transformative climate and institutional activism that we can in this very narrowing window that we have.
Right. And there's two questions that get obscured when you focus on what we call the impossible question, which is the should I have a baby in the face of the climate crisis? And one is an answer to like how harmful the future might be to my child is, how do we change that? How do we ameliorate that, right, on a systems level? And then to the question of what harm will come from my baby to the world, the question that obscures is, why is it so carbon intensive to have a kid in this country in the first place, right? The focus on the future carbon pollution that a child implies implies that amount will never change and that there's nothing we can do in order to change it, which is both, even if we do nothing, no one will ever emit as much as we do, but we can also work on purpose to make it less carbon intensive just to live. Right.
So population, overpopulation, these have really become kind of grounding stories in the global north, so much that it's often just thought of as common sense. And I'm wondering how we need to shift that narrative. What questions should we be asking?
Well, we wound up writing a lot about this and also working a lot with these ideas over the course of the last decade, in large part for the reasons that you mentioned, that like it's sort of seductive in its simplicity, right? Like more people equals more problems and people create their own poverty by having too many babies, blah, blah, blah. So there's a couple big problems with this interpretation. The first is one that Josephine just gestured to, which is that this is a question of consumption. And there's a little factoid that shows up a lot. You know, if everybody in the world consumed the way that middle-class Americans consumed, we need another 4.5 to 6 Earths worth of resources just to sustain that. So it's not actually, you know, people, it's what the systems in which people live that drive that consumption, right? So that's one problem. You know, and the sort of limit case of that is China's one child policy. During the time that the one child policy was in place, China's emissions rose to surpass those of the US. So it's pretty clear indication that suppressing people's human rights is not exactly a path to carbon reduction. But there's a few other problems with this approach, generally speaking, which is that, you know, most notably, it instrumentalizes women and makes women birthing people, many of whom are, most of whom are women. It creates a focus on oppressing and changing the behaviors, et cetera, pushing down on people who have less power than pushing up on the systems that are sort of strangling all of us, right? So it's easier to tell whole generations of, you know, women, young people, birthing people, what to do with their bodies than it is to tell, you know, the economy, politicians, the, you know, large companies that that are responsible for these emissions and for these sort of systemic factors to stop, right? So there's a question of who's sort of being intervened upon. And then third, the population movement has a very, very, very classist, very racist, very painful history. And we don't want any part of that. As recently as 2017, judges in the United States were offering to shave time off people's sentences for undergoing a quote voluntary sterilization while incarcerated, you know, for whatever dubious meaning the word voluntary has when someone is incarcerated. And this, I mean, it just, you know, there is a long and troubled history of involuntary sterilizations being enacted upon poor women, many of whom are women of color in the US and Canada. It's happened all over the world. And it's been baked into the international institutions of development, you know, as well.
And we say history, but this comes up to present day. And those are sort of more extreme examples. But the less extreme, more pervasive example is that when an NGO sets out to offer healthcare, reproductive healthcare, with the aim of population control, even in its most kind of modern form, people are receiving measurably poorer quality of care. Women are receiving measurably poorer quality of care. That is that, you know, when the object is not people's own self-determination, their own ideas about their reproductive health, it's someone else's idea. And if that idea is really mobilized toward emissions, you can be sure that the quality of care they're receiving is not adequate and is not guided by principles of justice.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things I find really powerful in your book is the way that you talk specifically about some of those histories and the ways that reproductive justice is a direct response to reproductive racism. Can you talk about how that history impacts your work and the way you approach these really sensitive topics?
We have relied heavily on the framework of reproductive justice, which came out of the reproductive justice movement, which today sort of the leading organization is Sister Song. They're a national multiracial organization that focuses on reproductive health and reproductive access using this framework. We are also aware that the term reproductive justice has been kind of borrowed, let's say, by a lot of groups doing the kind of aid work that we were just describing overseas. So it has been appropriated a lot, and especially by, you know, white people and white orgs with good intentions, maybe, or with their own intentions. So we're pretty careful to say that, like, while we honor the framework, we use the framework, we are not ourselves a reproductive justice organization, because we are taking this wonderful framework and bringing it to climate movement, where we think it's really overdue, it's really needed, and it's not widely understood or promoted, right? That even if people understand that, like, you know, overpopulation as a discourse is not great, a lot of people have at least the received wisdom that, like, but me having a baby is bad, right? And that there are liberatory ways of talking and thinking about this stuff that help us understand not just the scope of the problem, but, like, the beauty of the solutions, right? Like, the world that we can live in if we understand that everybody deserves reproductive self-sovereignty, and an understanding of history really guides like a just and more beautiful future.
Sister Song's definition of reproductive justice is that people should have the right to determine the number and spacing of their children, and also to parent in communities that are, I think, healthy and thriving is the language they use, or something similar. And that captures a racial justice component from which the movement originated, but B, this idea that justice in reproduction is not just about whether you can or can't, you know, choose to end a pregnancy or carry it to term, but rather that there are a host of justice-related issues. You know, in the United States, we're a very wealthy country, but our maternal mortality is, like, highest among the wealthy countries, and it is criminally so for women of color, right? So a reproductive justice framework asks us to look at the cost and the barriers to healthcare for people who are having babies, gestating. It asks us to look at things like asthma in neighborhoods. It asks us to look at things like food deserts. It asks us to look at things like gun violence that is perpetrated upon children in schools, right? So the ability to parent in just and thriving communities is expansive, and it points us at all these other places in the system that need attention. So, for instance, doulas, right? And this fight that's going on in different parts of the country right now about whether doula services are going to be covered by insurance. That's a reproductive justice issue, for instance. And it's not limited to, am I legally allowed to access an abortion or not, which is an important thing, obviously very important, and also not the only determinant of whether or not people can, you know, parent or not in ways that honor their own self-sovereignty and their needs.
Yeah, it's about so much more than just preventing and ending pregnancies. It's about the fact that we don't support people even when they do become parents in the U.S.
I mean, the U.S. is perfecting antinatalist policies in basically everything but name, right? So we have a no guaranteed parental leave. You know, if you're lucky, your workplace offers it. We, as mentioned, our maternal mortality rate is unbelievably high. The food deserts, the asthma, the various other, you know, dangers for health. In many states, childcare costs more than college. And you have this brain drain. I heard it described recently as, like, the feminized brain drain, where basically moms leave the workforce because they can't afford daycare. And, you know, there's a lot of good reasons to be a full-time parent if that's what you want, but there's also a lot of good reasons to be able to access daycare if that's what you want. And, you know, this is the thing we're struggling with in Rhode Island too, is that we don't have enough daycare providers because of our low wages and this and that. And that's it's very consequential for people sort of throughout the social structure.
I also feel like we tend to be reductive about who this impacts, right? That this is about women, this is about birthing people. How do you see your work as being universal and relevant to people far beyond those who identify in those ways?
One of the things that's so clear to us now, having done a decade of this work, is that while reproduction isn't the whole story, it's really like the heart of the story or the core of the story, because it touches on everything that is central to being a human. And there's a lot of reasons why this gets kind of slid into off the serious table onto like the feminized table. It's an odd thing, because everybody has the potential to reproduce. Everybody has parents. Everybody could have kids or create families however they want. But it does show us gender dynamics that were invisible before around the subject. It also shows us about race and class. It shows us about the inequities that are baked in already when climate shows up on the scene. So I think it's, for us, it was the key that unlocked this kind of vision of the problem and the solution, right? That we are linked to the past and the future through our family life, through our love relationships. And so when you start talking about reproduction and you start talking about family planning, when you view those inclusively or expansively, this is really like what it means to be alive. This is like what we love, what we're fighting for. And it touches almost everything we care about.
You know, within that, we have a very strong recognition that this issue affects different people differently. We live with it in different but interlocking ways all over the planet. But, you know, as a, you know, cis woman in a female body, I have a very different experience of, for instance, the overturn of Roe than my father does. And that's a real difference. Like, making sense of that is part of our job. And that as a white person, I have a very different experience of this than, for instance, a woman of color. We have, you know, even if we're both cis women, and that, you know, so it is certainly universally relevant, but it does not apply to people in universal ways. And that part of the job here is sort of picking apart and understanding with compassion and grace and building solidarities across those different ways. One of our big shticks is that, like, this whole like weird false divide between parents and non-parents is ridiculous, right? Like, grownups have a responsibility right now. Whether I have two kids or zero or six, again, doesn't matter so much. Like, my job as a grownup right now is to make the world safer to children that are born to me, to my sister, to somebody I don't know, you know, to my colleagues' kids, whatever. And that, you know, I think, again, some of this, we like kind of peculiar, like bizarre climate coverage about, you know, parents versus non-parent. Like, there's, again, you know, people feel tenderness around this because experiences are different, but instead of using that sort of as an opportunity for solidarity, I think there has been sort of both coverage and organizing that creates more divisions than it bridges. And I think personally that is not where we need to be going. We need more solidarities and more bridges. And we need to see the richness in each other's experiences as mechanisms for making our all of our understandings and our movements richer.
I also think that the idea that there is a right answer, that some people, that we should be having babies in the climate crisis, or we should not be having babies in the climate crisis, when you have the idea that there's a right answer, then the people who are making the wrong answer get excluded from the future vision. So we're talking about, you know, bringing parents and non-parents together. Another way of thinking about that is like, we are not all like making these decisions like from the same place, but also not for the same reasons. Like, one thing that we think a lot of people have conflated is like, having kids with optimism and not having kids with pessimism, right? And our experiences really don't bear that out, right? There are a lot of people who are having kids who are not particularly sanguine about future prospects, and a lot of non-parents who are like really excited about a lot of stuff that they're involved in, that they're seeing. I mean, and it's more complex than even that. But I think that making room for imperfect answers in a really unknowable future, like, we have in common that we want our kids, and that's kids broadly defined, we want them to be safe. We want them to be happy, to have fulfilled lives, have their needs met. And no parent can ever assure that. No community can ever assure that. But if we view that as the common good, then it makes things a lot clearer and also like a lot more meaningful.
I appreciate that nuance, and it feels so critical to having these conversations in a meaningful way. And I particularly liked the one reframe in the book where looking at the overlap between climate and sort of women's rights more broadly is the idea of what if we focus on educating boys and detoxifying masculinity? I think that's a really helpful way to show just how broad this topic is.
The bit in the book, for those of you who haven't read it, is that, you know, the Drawdown Project has a bunch of really excellent policy solutions, and we admire their work a lot. But we take them to task a little bit because they talk about, you know, educating women and girls as a carbon reduction strategy, which, you know, one, does that thing that we don't like of instrumentaling women's bodies and women's healthcare. But two, ignores this thing that goes on, this sort of cultural phenomenon in which green behaviors are seen and sort of caricatured as feminine. Marjorie Taylor Greene was a recent sort of example of, you know, calling men some sort of emasculating name if they drove a Prius. And we said, you know, detoxifying masculinity might also be a great carbon reduction strategy when you look at, for instance, who is rolling coal.
Oh yeah, I forgot about the coal rolling. I think that there's this funny way we know that we make up slightly more than half the global population, and then we'll have, you know, things like educating women and girls as a target that makes it sound like women and girls are this funny little like group of people off to the side that just, you know, that just something special and cute and weird about women and girls that needs this kind of special attention. I think it would be safe to say that education broadly, especially science education, would have like a major effect on carbon emissions. And the idea of making that gendered and saying that, like, implicitly saying that, like, men and boys are plenty educated enough and teaching them more will not reduce emissions. It's a weird implied framework. Yes.
And taking that further, you have an entire chapter looking at sort of women-led movements and the way they are demeaned and belittled in our culture. What do you hope that your women-led movement can do differently?
So I think we felt like we couldn't tell this story without also giving the historical context that we found ourselves in the midst of. But we are saying that in essence, like, the work we've done is not gendered in that way, that anyone and anyone's story is welcome here, and that we all can make meaning together. What we're pointing to is that those stories and those experiences are gendered, that we've had different experiences based on our identities, based on our position in many positions in this world. We found that a lot of movements organized around a gender identity or a parent identity had a lot of power, but had real limitations. Like, for example, organizing around the identity of mother invokes a kind of an archetype of mother that may not actually be that comfortable or that familiar to a lot of actual mothers, right? It has a huge amount of demonstrable political power, and it reifies stuff that maybe doesn't feel, you know, welcoming to everybody, and doesn't necessarily tell the whole story. So this is not like a knock on really powerful organizations doing really powerful work under parent identities and specifically mother identities. It's just to say that, like, any activism that's done from like who I am specifically at the exclusion of like who else might care about these things is potentially less inclusive than a coalition that has like a specific target, let's say.
At the same time, people with different identities tend to have patterns of experience that are demonstrably similar in societies, right? Like, so women broadly have, you know, a series of experiences related to how we present in the world and
rights and healthcare and all that kind of stuff. It's patterned by class, it's patterned by race, it's patterned by access, urban, rural, religion, all kinds of other things. So we do our best to, you know, just sort of stay open to how all of those dynamics are present for us, right? No movement, again, is going to be able to speak with exactly one voice for everybody. That's not the goal. The goal is to make enough space so that everybody gets to speak with their own voice in service of a shared goal.
When it comes to climate solutions, you say that individual people's decisions are the smallest levers available to us. And in addition to family planning, you're really thinking about this as introducing activism and political action. So what are those bigger levers that we should be focusing on to make positive climate solutions happen?
Yeah, so we do, we also don't want readers to feel as if individual decisions and individual actions have no meaning, right? We know that doing green things in the household, doing green things on the household level can be really empowering. They can be points of interaction. They can be teaching tools. They can be a lot of things. But we want to free people from the feeling that their consumption choices, their reproductive decisions, and the things that happen in their own home have like political weight because they're not big enough to, right? The scale that we're talking about is the collective scale. Politics is what we do collectively to change systems. So we hope that people find a little bit of freedom in there instead of feeling like the stuff that they're working on is not meaningful, or their family composition is in some way not meaningful. It's deeply meaningful and it happens on the personal level. So once you decide that you're going to get politically involved, or you decided that you're ready for climate action, the question is like, where do you start? Because it's such a staggering problem there, and the entry points are not always obvious. So the very first thing that we tell anybody who's willing to listen is to get together, right? To find people that feel what you're feeling, people who get what you're talking about, find people that share at least some part of your vision for what you'd like to do. And that could be pre-existing groups. Joining a group is like a very straightforward way to get involved, but it could also just be like knocking on your neighbor's door, right? And having a conversation about what's going on in the neighborhood or at the, you know, city or town level. From there, we frame it into like two broad categories, which is the big yes and the big no. And the big yes is like, what do we need more of, right? We know we need a huge green revolution, but specifically we need more renewable energy. We need more green space. We need more, public transit that's free if possible, but definitely affordable. Any good that we want to see in the future, that's in the big yes category. And the big no is like, there is so much bad stuff that needs stopping right away. So that's pipelines, that's coal plants, that's, you know, more and more SUVs. You've got other examples.
Yeah, that's blood diamonds. That's like bad investments in organizations' retirement portfolios. But to differentiate the big and the small, right? Like a small yes is like, yes, I want a backyard garden. But a big yes is, yes, we need a community garden. It's something that's bigger. So for both the yes and the no, we have a couple of criteria, right? So it has to be bigger than me. If I want to be participate in either a big yes or a big no, the thing I have to be doing is bigger than me and my own household and my own whatever. And it has to be inspiring to me. Like it turns out that I, Megan Coleman, have a real love of public transit, which is not a thing that I studied in school. It's the thing I learned about as I made policy about it. So it's like fun, and not every job associated with everything that I do around public transit is fun, but like fundamentally, I think this is like a pretty cool thing and I'm excited about it. Along those lines, it is powered for me by a vision of a life worth living. So like I live in a small state with a statewide bus system. And also I dream of a state where everyone can get wherever they need to go without driving and fast, you know, and buses and trains operated by people who are compensated a living wage. That's like part of that vision.
And then finally, it's got to be a project, not a general idea, right? So we're putting it in this human scale, right? There's it has to be bigger than you, but it can't be like something so big that you'll never accomplish it in this lifetime.
Right. So like ending capitalism, wrong answer. That's, you know, maybe that's people's goals, but like a step is getting your bank to defund a pipeline, right? Or getting your retirement portfolio at your job to divest from coal or whatever. But there's a difference between like sort of a general vision and then the projects that you take or take up in pursuit of that general vision. And so that project versus general idea is often where we see the pitfalls because the problems are massive. And we say, it's like, well, what good would my, you know, defunding this pipeline do? It's like, yeah, but you know, the tipping points for defunding pipelines are sometimes lower than we think that they are. We actually just had a conversation with some young people about this the other day from a university around divestment.
And so one of the things that is nice about the big yes and the big no framing and doing it collectively is you, in order to pick one, you automatically can't pick everything, right? You have to limit yourself to something that you can be involved in, that you have the capacity to do. And you have to have faith that other people are picking up the other jobs that are not, you know, possible for you. There's faith in the group that otherwise I think we have not been acculturated to feel, which is like the question a lot of people are asking themselves is like, but what can I do? And there is nothing that I personally can do that addresses the climate crisis in its entirety. Like it's not possible. And so the question, what can we do? And like, while we're doing that, what are you going to do? Like, those are questions that start to feel a little bit more possible and a little bit more humane.
Yeah, we're bigger than the challenges that we face only at the scale of each other.
And we don't need to blame individuals for the choice to have kids or not to have kids.
Well, and it's also really important to note that not everyone is in the position to choose. You know, there are a whole bunch of reasons why I might have several kids or none at all that have nothing to do with my choice. That they have to do with my economic status, with my body chemistry, with my trauma history, with whatever. And there's space for that too, right? Like the whole sort of unburdening of the individual consequences is really where we're at. I mean, we make this point in the book and it's a little bit macabre, but like, if you follow the personal carbon reduction if you follow the personal carbon footprint reduction strategy all the way to its logical end, right, you get to the point where you could kill yourself. And I don't say that to be callous, but I do say that to suggest that like one fewer person, if I didn't exist, we're no closer to solving systemic injustices than if I did, right? Like the litmus or like the limit case proves the point that only together are we capable of doing things that need doing at the scale that they need doing.
Thank you both for joining us today on Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali. This is Brianna Drexler.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, Brianna. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, senior editor at Yes Media and host of Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Our audio podcast is on iTunes and Spotify.